Yeah, so this week's lecture is Eastern art, which, as mentioned last week, is going to be a lot of crushing huge amounts of information into a very small space. Thankfully, the developments in Eastern art tend to happen very quickly, and then they tend to kind of last a long time unchanged, especially once we hit China, where we have predomination of styles that continue on and on and on, a bit like in ancient Egypt, where you can find 3,000 years worth of unchanged art. Not that it's totally unchanged once we hit China, but that's a bit later on. So when we're talking about Eastern art, essentially we're kind of doubling back on ourselves, because we're at the point in our history of Western art where the West and the East are meeting a lot more because of trade and because of kind of the development of capitalism and things like that. And so Eastern art is having a big influence suddenly on Western art. So it's a good time to turn back round and see what the history of Eastern art is. In terms of, I guess, the traditions of art, every single culture has its own art, every society has its own art. If humans are involved, there is art being made, is the general rule. However, when we talk about traditions that have kind of built up over thousands of years of people passing on information and kind of passing on skills, we can see that there are two big kind of trajectories. There's the Western trajectory and the Eastern trajectory. And there's some places will fit between the two, and there's often a lot of commonalities, but there's two kind of directions, and there's a lot of commonalities between them, but we'll see some differences as well. There's a suggestion that there might have been a kind of third of these kind of great movements in art that arose from nothing and was self-contained in South America, like the Mayans and the Incas and the Aztecs, but all of that's been destroyed and lost, and so we can only kind of see it in retrospect. But where in the West we have kind of civilization emerging in Mesopotamia for the first time, being kind of pioneered to its highest extent in Egypt, it then goes to Greece, to Rome, through the Dark Ages, then re-emerges in the Renaissance, and from the Renaissance on we have this Western tradition. As we'll see in our lecture on Eastern art, we have an equally sort of about equally timed emergence of civilization from the Indus Valley that then kind of expands out, and we have a growth of art emerging in sort of the Indian subcontinent and that area of the world. It develops through phases of the Hindu religion into the Buddhist religion. It moves through the Buddhist religion up into China, where it then goes through a succession of developments again, develops a certain language that it follows, which is similar, I guess, to the way that it becomes stratified and the language is created in the Renaissance. And the Eastern art tradition kind of follows that trajectory, and it's a self-contained tradition until the 19th century, when it starts talking a lot more to Western art and the two kind of merge a lot more. So in terms of what we're going to be looking at, here's another piece of Eastern art, probably quite similar to the one we looked at before. It's got some trees, some birds, very nice, peaceful, flat kind of art. The core of what we're going to be talking about will focus a lot on the differences rather than similarities, simply because you'll find a lot in here which is similar, because art is art after all. But the biggest difference on a technical level is that the Eastern tradition never developed linear perspective, that mathematical type of perspective that comes around in the Renaissance, which is a kind of maths of the page, where you can take a two-dimensional canvas and you can recreate the exact spaces of a 3D kind of space on it. And that illusionism, that sense of depth, that sense of kind of active seeing, is instead all those energies in the Eastern tradition go into thinking about the page as a two-dimensional space, having sort of positive and negative space, as we'd use it in the graphic design sense, having flat kind of a flat sense of composition. And as such, there are far more there is kind of a perspective, but it tends to be about foreground and background, as opposed to the kind of linear type of perspective. So it's not as if there's not perspective, but things like composition, and particularly the kind of approach of like presence and absence, things that are seen and things that are unseen, the space between what's being shown, what's not being shown, those kind of questions are developed to a far more sophisticated level in the Eastern tradition compared to the Western tradition. And this comes out of all sorts of things, social, but also religious. So you can see, for example, like depictions of Jesus tend to be him looking directly on at you or looking up at heaven. He's a very active looker, whereas the depictions of the Buddha tend to be either with entirely closed eyes, seeing a kind of inner space, or with a kind of slightly sort of lazy look to the eyes, like it's a very dreamlike, looking out at this world that doesn't matter. And so, yeah, we have simultaneously this difference in technique, but also a difference in kind of the philosophy of seeing. And the function of art as well is also subtly different in that where in the West there tends to be a kind of aspirational quality to art, not all the time, but that tends towards the heroic. In the Eastern tradition, there is also heroic art, but the larger tendency is towards tranquility and peace and things that you can sort of look at and get a more gentle sense of enjoyment from, rather than a kind of aggressive theatricality that comes from Western art. So yeah, we're going to go through the very primitive arts of the East into the Gupta period Indian art, where we get the first sort of set of communication between East and West, then moving over to China and then Japan to sort of see us out, because that will kind of bring us up to the 19th century in our Eastern art tradition. So if you look at some of the ancient art, we'll find things like Konkan cave art from 10,000 BC in India. This sort of stuff is fascinating because it's kind of carved directly into the stone. And it's coming around at the same time that we're finding cave paintings across all of the world. And there's cave paintings as well in sort of India and the Indus Valley. But here we're finding it carved in with these figures. This one is the Master of Animals, which is a man here with a strange kind of head with a slit in it. He's holding two animals above his head. And we also have the Goddess of Fish here, which is a female figure with fishes surrounding her and kind of moving towards her. So this seems to be some kind of maritime or fish goddess. We can also find in the Indus Valley civilization a lot of kind of sacred objects to do with fertility. So there's a seated woman of Catalhoyuk from around 6000 BC, which you'll recognize has a lot in common with the Willendorf Venus, the kind of sculpture which is associated with granting you fertility, that is we theorized at the start of the year that this was kind of to do with fertility cults and wishing to kind of become pregnant. It's a symbol of abundancy, and these were either carved by women or at least were kind of worshipped and celebrated by women. There's also a lot of mysteries, as there is in any ancient art. So in China, we have the Bai discs from around 2000 BC. These are some of the very, very earliest things ever found in China, and we have absolutely no idea really what their function was. The safest bet is they were some kind of jewelry, and a slightly more, I guess, outlandish for the time bet would be that they were some kind of currency, because currency then doesn't return to China or anywhere else for like 2,000 years. So we have these amazingly polished and carved discs that are in a sort of perfect circle. You see them turning up on kind of imaginary ancient Chinese costume or sort of embedded in different things, but that's a nice little mystery if you ever want to get into it. And we also have the kind of more bloodthirsty art forms that are maybe more reminiscent of Viking art. So this is one of many, there's many similar axes to this. This is from the Xing dynasty in China, a ceremonial axe from 1000 BC. Which it's believed to be an axe that would kind of eat the soul or the energy of the person being killed. It's designed for killing criminals, the criminal doesn't deserve to kind of pass on to the next world, so you embed this kind of demon into the axe, and as you cut someone's head off, it'll eat their soul so that they won't be able to continue on. And we also have kind of more exaggerated characteristics like this piece from Jomon Japan, the Jomon era, around 400 BC, which is a sort of stone statue with sort of interesting facial characteristics. I really like the conspiracy theory that this is an astronaut who landed in ancient Japan, because it sort of looks like one, even though it definitely isn't. But in terms of our story, kind of our narrative of civilizations rising out of culture. So all of these are separate cultures. They all have kind of important things going on within them. They have their own art styles, and, you know, as anywhere in the world does, the humans always make art. But the story of this is a kind of trajectory and a tradition emerges out of the Indus Valley. So the Indus Valley is geographically situated in what's now the borderlands between Pakistan and India and up into the Himalayas, so what we probably now call like up to Nepal and over to Tibet, that kind of mountainous region down to the sea, areas like the Punjab and things like that were where the Indus Valley runs and where the Indus Valley civilization emerged. And the Indus Valley civilization is interesting because whereas in the Western kind of if you go before the Egyptians, you end up with the Babylonians and the Assyrians and those kind of Mesopotamian groups. And they were always at constant war with each other. There's always a kind of ongoing war between those sort of first big, huge city-dwelling groups. The Indus Valley civilization is incredibly peaceful by comparison. It's an emergence of kind of city groups, city-dwelling groups with hierarchies in the same way as we saw with the Standard of Ur. But those hierarchies seemed incredibly stable because there was no competing civilization. Everyone was part of the Indus Valley civilization, or they lived in the surrounding kind of woods or plains, or, you know, they were nomadic people. So there was no competition directly. So it was a very peaceful kind of era until the invasion of the more warlike Vedic peoples from the north. But you can see, even here in this very ancient art, which is a kind of highly developed sculpture, it looks very much more human than some of the more ancient stuff that we've seen. We can see in it a whole range of kind of aspects which come to return again and again and again in these art forms. So the image of the closed or like very, very almost closed eyes, which we will, you know, see a lot in images of the Buddha. So this isn't a statue looking out at the world, it's a statue that's kind of experiencing an inner peace and inner bliss. And we have across the head here in the form of a kind of amulet, the third eye, which eventually develops just into the red dot on the forehead as a symbol of the third eye. And also we have a lot of these curlicue, almost kind of Celtic markers on the thing, like sash kind of thing that's going over. So we have already at this very early stage the markers of this art and what the kinds of idealized figure looks like. Now, the thing with the next stage of development, because you have the invasion of the Vedic peoples, and you have the development of Hinduism, so we're skipping all of that because we need to keep moving. But with the emergence of Buddhism, we have the emergence of kind of the other big influence on Eastern art, which is this tension between the seen and the unseen, between what you show and you don't show. The technical term for it is the, aniconic style or aiconic style. As separate from the iconic style, the creation of icons, the depiction of things like human beings in the flesh or in stone, the aniconic style is showing things by not showing them. And this was part of the early kind of early Buddhism's refusal to show the Buddha, because the idea being that the Buddha has left this world, and so showing the Buddha on this world, even in statue form, kind of goes against the religion. The idea of depicting gods is also happening at the same time over on the slightly further to the west, where you've got kind of traditional views in the Old Testament emerging at this time, where you can't depict God in Judaism. But here we have a stupa, which is a very early form of temple developing out of the kind of northern Indian subcontinent. And it's based around this large dome, which is empty, but it symbolizes this cavernous emptiness, that kind of womb-like emptiness is symbolizing the Buddha, even though we don't see the Buddha. And it's a processional space, so you don't go into it and worship. Like with Egypt, you process around it. You come together with all of the various amulets and singing songs and playing music and doing chants and worshipping your religion by walking around the stupa. And as you walk around it, there are then pieces of art surrounding the stupa which tell the story of the Buddha's sort of moving through the world and reaching enlightenment. So we have lots of grotesques like these here, which are demonstrating the kind of horrible world that we live in. You can see that writhing organic nature that's a bit like the Gothic almost. So you see these things tying together all the way through. But we also see things like the heavenly chair of the Buddha here, which is a chair that's got no one in it. So that's another good way. If you want to show someone without showing them, you can show an empty chair and people worshipping the empty chair. And so here we have a journey from the kind of rather sort of large, leery, violent, scary-looking, demonic forms of people. And as you walk the way that Buddha would walk, and he goes through them and he sees the minor gods and he sees the kings and he sees the sort of traders, and he moves up away from the kind of the normal people into the purer light and air of religion, and then out of that to become the heavenly king, and once he's sort of reached that point, he then transcends into nirvana and disappears entirely. And so the hope for these worshippers is that by following this path, you could kind of follow the path of the Buddha, and it would help you to attain your own enlightenment as well. A bit more aniconic art here is borrowed from Persia. So these are Persian columns that were taken, the design of them were taken by the Buddhists and kind of incorporated into aniconic Buddhist art. And so you can see there's a whole range of different things that are occurring here that are all telling you about the Buddha without showing the Buddha. So there's the three lions, which are taken just a direct lift from Persian art. They're being kind of, lions being a symbol of nobility. You know, they're at the top of the food chain. If you want to be anything, if you're king of the jungle, if you want to be any animal other than human, you'd probably want to be a lion, because they, you know, no one can challenge the lion. And so there's the three lions looking out to every corner of the world. And they're stood on a pillar, so they're at the apex and at the top, which makes them the most important. Down at the bottom we have a lotus, and the lotus is also the symbol of the Buddha. And the reason for this is because the lotus plant, it's like a water lily, essentially, and it grows down in the mud and the muck at the bottom of the pond, and it puts out its, you know, roots into the mud, and it sort of lives in the mud for most of the year, and then suddenly it rises up on a big long stalk and it bursts forward at the top of the water, and from that comes a beautiful white flower. And so this is representing the Buddha kind of being mired in the kind of goo of the world, all the horrible organic kind of mess, and by engaging with that and by drawing lessons from it, he emerges above the water into this heaven, which in the case of the lotus flower is our world, and he blossoms into this beautiful thing. And we also have the wheel, which again, the wheel is a symbol of, well, in this case it's a symbol of fate, as it is in medieval Europe, but it's also a symbol of the eternal recurrence, the eternal kind of death and rebirth, that reincarnation cycle, which is the cycle of life and death under Buddhism. Now, towards in the aftermath of the invasion of Alexander the Great, because Alexander the Great, it's often forgotten, did so much conquering that he took over all of the Western world and carried all the way on until he hit India, northern India. Alexander the Great essentially took members of his family and made them local kings before he'd sort of died, and his empire collapsed very quickly, but his influence lasted a lot longer. And so there's a series of kings of the kind of northern Indian peninsula that were Greeks by ethnicity, but they very quickly, within a couple of generations, became integrated into the sort of Hindu and Buddhist societies there. And part of this is known as the Gupta period. Part of this period involves a lot of transference of artistic skills. So a lot of the kind of classical period art of kind of how to make sculpture so that they look very, very human and anatomically correct, a lot of that moves over into the Eastern tradition. But equally, the kind of slightly undeveloped polytheism that is current in Europe at the time kind of gets melded into Hinduism and transformed into something a lot more spiritually and philosophically kind of complicated and interesting. And so we see figures like Apollo and Hercules quickly dying back and being replaced by similar figures in the Hindu and the Buddhist tradition. And part of all this melding creates the idea of the Bodhisattva. And the Bodhisattva is a Buddha who chooses to return to Earth to help other people move towards Buddhahood. And this is a really convenient myth, because it allows that idea of an iconic kind of by necessity you cannot depict the Buddha to kind of be not entirely dispensed with, but to be worked around. So you can now depict the Buddha, but as a Bodhisattva. So someone has attained Buddhahood who's come back, and they're now kind of a hero figure in the model of the heroes that we've seen so far. And so we have this figure here. This is a Gupta period Bodhisattva statue from Gandhara. It's about 100 AD this came about. And we can see how it's very clearly a figure from the Buddhist tradition, but we have integrated the sun, which, you know, is the halo in Christianity, but it's also the son of Apollo, which is also Ra, and that symbol of Ra that comes out of Egypt. But it's also the circle, so it combines with this idea of the wheel and the eternal recurrence as well. It takes on a new significance. So, yeah, the specifically Hindu style emerges in later Gupta period art, where the kind of the lessons of the Bodhisattva are then integrated back into polytheism, and we have this new sense of fecundity, of like nature sprouting eternal variations of itself. And so we have in Gupta period art a lot of one central figure compositions that are then surrounded by lots and lots and lots of smaller figures and lots of kind of complex decorative styles. So here we have a huge decorative ring that's sort of emphasizing and celebrating that idea of the kind of holiness of the figure. And down below we have lots and lots of figures and people, all of them demonstrating that there's loads, all of life is contained within it. This is also partly to do with the swelling of the cities, and that these city-states grow larger and larger and larger, and you have large movements of people. And so it's a time and a place where there's large crowds everywhere, and it's integrated into the art. We can see this again here with the sleeping sort of bodhisattva there, and then all sorts of figures surrounding them in different states of war and peace, and the sort of men and women, and there's lots of kind of movement, and everything, every spare inch is kind of filled with life and with energy. The idealized figures of this time are also particularly notable for this voluptuousness, that if you go to Hindu temples in northern India, you tend to find that they've got compared to the Western women, which in, you know, Athenian women tended to be a lot more kind of masculine looking. They would look quite tough, they had strong shoulders, and Egyptian women looked a lot kind of like, it's that flapper style, everything very geometrical, very straight. The kind of fashions and the emphasis placed in this culture were a lot more on emphasizing sort of, I guess, yeah, fecundity. The kind of all abundantness of fleshiness kind of thing. Even the men tend to have a kind of fleshiness, as if they've got an extra layer of fat around their muscles. You don't get many of those Greek like skinny boys where you can see all the six packs. The statues tend to have a lot more kind of padding around them, because it's to do with celebrating, you know, eating, drinking, living the good life, and having a successful kind of family and kind of spreading and growing. And a lot of the animals are kind of fitting in with this sort of riding and moving between the figures and the temples. Now, Gupta period architecture is fascinating because it develops out of the stupa into a new sort of integration of temple elements, some of them taken from kind of the classical period, but very quickly integrated. And so we have in Gupta period architecture this central tower, which is serving the function of the stupa. It's an empty presence. It's signifying an absence. It's a present absence. So this is entirely empty, but it's there to show you that this is the kind of the empty presence at the core of being, is how a Hindu philosopher would see it. But around the stupa, we now have a temple that's built in order to hold worshippers. And so you can move in and out of the temple, you can have ceremonies in there, you can gather together as a kind of collective, as a community, and you can celebrate things within that temple structure. And so it's becoming a lot more kind of communal in the way that we see the, rather than a processional thing, in the same way that we see kind of Egyptian moving into classical. And this developed this style through a series of iterations until we get really highly developed ones like this one, the Kandira Mahadeva temple from 1000 AD. And interestingly, the way that this develops is in line with what we now call the Mandelbrot sequence, the idea of a kind of algorithmic copying on of sort of organically expanding sort of series of circles in this case. So we have the central stupa, but it has given birth to a series of smaller ones around it, which in turn give birth to similar smaller ones there. And so we have this kind of almost algorithmic, organic growing out of one big space gives birth to 10 smaller spaces that creates 10 smaller spaces. And they kind of emerge from each other in a very organic way. It gives this totally unique and fascinating architecture, which you don't really see anywhere else. But it all follows very specific mathematical rules of replication. rules that you find in the natural world all the time. It's the same set of algorithms which determine where a tree will give off branches and where it will grow leaves on those branches and twigs and things like that. It replicates the organic. Now, as a result of probably the temperature, but also a lot of upheaval, we don't have a huge amount of evidence for what ancient painting looked like in the Gupta period or before. So here's some of the only examples we have of Gupta period painting. And we can see how it has a lot of sort of familiar aspects from what we've seen before. We have gods with slightly closed eyes, this kind of inner peace sort of look to them. We have women with the kind of sense of sort of voluptuousness that we can see in the temple statuary. And we have a kind of increasing number of forms of Buddhas where lots and lots and lots and lots of little gods all scattered together. Now, it's about this time, this is between 100 BC and 650 AD, this is the Ajanta cave paintings, that we see Buddhism moving out of India, where it's been developing along with all of these many different religions simultaneously, and over the Himalayas in the direction of China. And so here we have the Mughal caves from 450 AD. And they're quite fascinating because they look very much like something that should be in India, but it's moved up through the Himalayas and through Nepal and through all those areas where we have sort of, for example, the Tibetan Book of the Dead is just a huge long list of various different gods and demons and things like that that you want to help you move through the afterlife. And here we have them all depicted in this cave, but it's in China at this point. And if you can see in some of the grottos like this one, you can see how there's this generational shift in styles, so that you've got certain figures that look very clearly influenced by Hinduism, some that are more kind of the Buddhism of China, and then you've got more recent images that are very clearly kind of Chinese, Japanese, like samurai looking kind of warrior figures. And you can see all these different figures overlapping. It's a really fascinating cave. You can also see in something like the Diamond Sutra of 880 AD, the painterly style, what evidence we have of it, of the kind of Hindu Buddhist art of the Gupta period moving into China. And as it gets there, Chinese artists are still working in Chinese styles, but there's this huge overabundance of things. So we have our central Bodhisattva there, but we've got like hundreds of figures all around him, and the level of detail is just so intense that it's really hard to work out like what's the floor and what's the lion and what's this chap down here. And you know, what are details on the throne that he sat by? There's just loads and loads of details. There's a demon up there as well. This level of sort of detail sits halfway between the sort of Chinese and the traditional Indian styles. You can see it again in Wu Daozi's 87 Immortals from 700 AD, where we have a procession this time of lots and lots and lots of gods. This one is a detail, in fact, of a long scroll which carries on for like 15 feet of lots and lots of tiny little sort of drawings of different sort of gods and goddesses. And immortals could also be kind of historical figures or they could be religious figures. There doesn't tend to be that separation that you see in, for example, medieval art, where you'll have bishops and kings like a separate, warriors and great kind of spiritual leaders being separate. You tend to find that emperors and empresses and kind of high priests sort of meld into each other a lot in these, especially when you read the Chinese classics, where you've always got monks who are warriors and warriors who turn into monks, like Genji or Lu Dao from the Stories of the Marsh, whatever it is, Water Margin. So here's a detail from, this is some Tang period art, which is a little bit later, after we get the development of Confucius. So that early period of Chinese art is largely dominated by Buddhism, but then it comes to meet with the two sort of native Chinese philosophies of, so the Buddhism becomes Zen Buddhism through mixing with Taoism, which is all about balance, about kind of the light and the dark. The yin-yang symbol is the symbol of Taoism, and Confucianism. And Confucianism is really, if you want to boil it down to a core premise, it's the idea of peace and stability through hierarchy, that as long as you do your part, everyone that relies on you can do their parts well. But as soon as one part of the hierarchy is weakened, the whole pyramid collapses. And so it's a philosophy that works well with a kind of religion of Buddhism where it's a lot more calm and peaceful. So not necessarily a Tibetan Buddhism, which is all about lots and lots of gods, but one that's very kind of peaceful and depends upon like appreciation of the small things in life. So here is a long, long scroll from the Tang period. You can only just about see this at the top. It's because I'm going to do some blow-ups of it here. You read these right to left, and so this is sort of giving us the story of a journey. And so we begin over in the corner, and we see there's some nice herdsmen with their cows. We have this big empty space signifying the kind of the waters. We see a boatman coming in. And as people are jumping off the boat, they're heading in to... There we go. Into a little sort of rustic rural space where we find some nobles, and the nobles are sitting around a table. And what are they doing? They are doing what we're seeing here. They're creating a scroll. And so it's like a bit of art to celebrate making art. And it doesn't have any kind of hidden depths in the sense of that there's like hidden meanings or any allegories or characters that you need to know to understand it. It's largely a self-contained piece that just celebrates, I guess, the calm and the quiet sentiment that is emerging with the philosophy of Confucius in the Tang era. And the importance of this stuff is kind of emphasized by what happened at the end of the Tang era, where we end up with the Five Dynasties and Ten Kingdoms period. So the history of China is largely defined by its geography, and that its geography is, whereas Europe is full of lots and lots of like mountains and rivers and woods, it makes it very difficult to take over all of, you know, Europe in one big go. And so you can have wars all the way through European history, hundreds and hundreds and thousands and thousands of wars, and it never ends up in anything too cataclysmic until we have modern warfare. In China, it's the opposite. It's very open, it's quite flat, and it's all warfare involves millions of people. And so you have these large periods of peace interspersed by periods of just unbelievable cataclysm and death. So the Tang period, there's a long period of sort of peace inspired by Confucius, ends with there being five dynasties and ten kingdoms all happening simultaneously. And somewhere between like a fifth and a quarter of the people in China all die in this one big war. We then have a long period of peace in which we have the three kingdoms at the end of that, where there's another gigantic war. And as a result of this, the idea that any time there is war, there is just cataclysmic, massive, wide-scale war, is one of the big underlying reasons why this art is so peaceful, because peace is something they really want to aim for. And so the first period of that, you can see here in the kind of Tang Dynasty emerging into, a piece, where is it, from Zhao Fang, Palace Ladies Tuning the Lute, 800 AD. It's just a sort of quiet celebration of the many noble art forms. One of the many noble art forms, which is playing music. Every Chinese noble was expected to be able to play a series of music instruments. They were all expected to know how to recite poetry, how to fight, but also how to play go was one of the things you had to do, and how to ride a horse, how to do archery. And these fine noble kind of pursuits were there to maintain stability, to encourage people to become rounded individuals, so that they could take their place in the Confucian society that was a lot more peaceful. So classical China comes around after the kind of peace emerges again. And at this time, we have in classical China's sort of the rules emerge in the same way that the rules of composition and perspective emerge in the Renaissance. We have Xie He's book, The Six Principles of Chinese Painting, is the absolute classic cornerstone foundation of Chinese painting and Chinese art, how to appreciate it, how to go about it. He was a writer, an art historian, an artist himself, and a critic in 5th century China. And he saw the importance of art can be broken down into six things. The spirit resonance, which is vitality. It's the idea of kind of the overall flow and feeling and energy of the piece, that this is the most important thing. Followed quickly after by bone method, which is the way of using the brush or the pen, or in this case the bone, so that the actual way in which you're using it, the marks that you leave on the paper or on the silk or whatever it is that you're kind of working with, that those marks themselves have an art form to them, which is something that we don't see developing in the Western style at all until it's come over from China, the appreciation for kind of showing your working rather than hiding it. Is that sort of thing that Rembrandt was kind of verging on in his old age, or albeit without any kind of theory behind it? Correspondence to the object, which is essentially the realist's ideal, the kind of thing that we're used to seeing. It's like, is art good? We can judge that by looking at the thing it's depicting and then looking at the art. Does it look the same? Suitability to type is also, it's like, is it appropriate? Does it have the right colours? Does it have the right sort of approach? Is the tone of it accurate? Division and planning, which corresponds to the idea of composition, which has a much sort of higher place, I suppose, once you think about it as being a flat piece of paper with presences and absences. And then transmission by copying, which is how have you used the existing tradition and brought them forward. So this transmission by copying, the final bit, is also kind of part of this Confucian idea that you should always learn from prior masters, that simply doing something because it's new is a negative rather than a positive. So here we'll have a couple of Song period pieces. So the Song period comes around after a series of civil wars have destroyed the nation. And there's some really nice pieces, which is the Song period is when we move away from depicting people and towards depicting landscapes and kind of plants and animals and things within the landscape. They become pretty much the sole subject matter for art in the Song period. So here we have a huge blank space. And then in the background, as we mentioned at the start, we have kind of environmental effects, suggesting mountains, suggesting that we're perhaps in a kind of misty area. The mists are disappearing, and we have a nice kind of crooked series of trees that appear to be sort of lifting out of a river, or they're kind of cowering in rocks. It's a scene of the end of winter, the start of spring. There are buds dotted intentionally on all of these crooked branches. And the idea of this is partly to depict the scene itself in this kind of nice and peaceful way, that you could hang this up in your home and it would have a kind of calming effect. But also it's a reflection, a kind of obtuse reflection perhaps, but a reflection upon the time itself and upon the fact that the whole nation has just come out of a time of tremendous danger, civil war, death, destruction. And so the mists of the past, the horror of the past, are moving away, and it's revealing these horrible crooked shapes. This is the state of the nation, the state of the people in the aftermath of this horrible war. But amongst all this crookedness, the windswept, cracked and broken branches, there are buds emerging. And so we can sense that, you know, life is returning. Things are coming back. It's all going to blossom. It's all going to bloom. The mists are going to be washed away. And we're going to have spring again. Spring will come again. Another piece that's similar to this is Zhao Mengjian's Three Friends of Winter. You can see this idea of bone method being used slightly differently here. So whereas the bone method here is kind of crooked use of lots of appropriate use of inks in a rough manner, here we've got some very deliberate use of the ink in straight lines. Almost looks like a ruler's been used for these furs. And this one is called Three Friends of Winter, which I believe are the fir tree, the white plum blossom, and I've forgotten the third friend. Either way, the Three Friends of Winter are the three plants that bloom during the winter months in China. And so this, as well as being just, again, a nice, peaceful, restful, balanced composition, showing good bone method and a kind of... it's a lot more balanced as a composition as well because of that straightness of line that's appropriate to it. But it's another comment politically upon kind of coming out of a time of winter, of political winter, of kind of social destruction. Because in the midst of, even in the midst of winter, we have our three friends of winter, our three plants that can still bloom and still live in these horrible circumstances. And it's from those that, you know, the hope of the kind of state re-emerging comes about. We also have a kind of increasing minimalization of visual elements in the Song period, such that we have bits of colour, but largely reducing everything to just simple ink work, no backgrounds, or just the slightest suggestion of a background using washes and very light touches of inks or suggestions in the corner of the palette. This one has been stamped within an inch of its life. I'm not quite sure why. These stamps are normally kind of ones for the workshop, ones for the individual artist, but here we've got like 56 of them. Maybe it's the same different people that have owned it over the years. I don't quite know. The end of the Song period, you have another cataclysm, and then things return in the Ming period. So the Ming period is most famous for, well, the Song period ends with the Mongol invasion. Once the Mongols go away, we end up with the Ming period. It's most famous for the Ming vases, which has become a kind of word to define anything that's this kind of particular blue lacquerware style. The high level of ceramic work in China is for a number of reasons. Partly it's because there's just loads of pottery, loads of clay. It's very, you know, prevalent. It's very easy to construct. And so much more highly developed art styles develop from it. But also there's a really interesting argument made about, because the Chinese never developed glass in the way that it's developed in the West. And glass is useful for loads of stuff, not just drinking from, or, you know, having windows that, you know, don't let in wind. Eventually you end up with people like Spinoza making glasses for people. So there's a huge importance to glass. And it never really develops in China. And there is an argument that it's to do with the fact that the West had wine as its kind of thing of choice for nobles to drink. And part of the biggest pleasure of wine is seeing it. Because if you look into a cup that's full of wine, it just looks black and horrible if it's red wine. And if it's white wine, it just looks a bit yellow and gross. So if you create glass, glass became this designer luxury object that gets developed and developed because it's initially as a kind of luxury object to celebrate wine. Whereas the kind of most cultivated alcoholic beverage that you would drink in China, well, they're all clear. There's various different types of rice wine, different, you know, sake, things like that, all of which are clear. And so drinking them from ornate kind of ceramic bowls is a lot more pleasurable, whereas glass wouldn't really do anything because you'd just be looking at white liquid in a glass. And so Ming vases are some of the most developed, and we have things emerging in the Ming period as well, like different styles, such as the giware, which is this, where you intentionally crack the vase so that it creates an interesting patina, a very sort of developed sense of the texture and the substance, the materials of the object as being part of its enjoyment. You also get clever things where they'll build sculptures out of ivory into it through baking it with wax and stuff like that. So yeah, we've got four masters of the classical sort of China Ming period that we'll go through one by one, just looking at one of each of their things. And we can get a sense of the way that the Ming integrate loads of the stuff that's gone before. They've got a classical sense of balance, a classical sense of proportion, a celebration of nature that's taken from the Song period, but also from the Tang period, a sense of like the drama of individual life. So this is a piece by Tang Yin called Drinking at Night from 1523. And so we have nature running its course. We have some cracked and broken sort of trees. We've also got some nice luscious trees. And in here we've got three people around a table drinking away, having a nice party as the night's setting. We have Qi Ying's Red Cliff, and we have the cliff in the distance, the slow, we can feel the sort of slow but steady pace of this group of sort of surrounding one nobleman as they move across this water feature. And again, it's that use of proportion, that by having this small little boat with loads of negative space around it, and some large looming kind of rocks on one side, and here just the lightest touch of, that doesn't show a coast, it just kind of is a suggestion of a coast clouded away in mist, that it creates this sense of scale and a sense of absence around them. So that kind of visual emptiness almost suggests a kind of visual equivalent to quietness. So that when you're, you know, if you've ever been out rowing late at night or just on a quiet lake, you'll appreciate that sound of the lapping waves, the sound of slow movements. As the red sun is going down in the background, it's evening, they're crossing this sort of large expanse of water. It's very peaceful, there's some movement, but it's sort of very gentle. And that real balance is what kind of sells it. Then we've got Wen Zhangming's Summer Retreat in the Eastern Grove. Here we can sort of appreciate some of the sense of depth and perspective that is available in sort of Eastern art. So it's not linear, but you can get a lot of depth effects by using environmental effects and by using a kind of foreground, background setup, so that it gets a little bit confused up here, admittedly. But by using the kind of spaces that are created, you can create quite complex sort of environments and landscapes as long as you don't verge too much into it. Rather than having to deal with, once you introduce linear perspective, you have to depict everything in the scene, otherwise it looks weird. And so here the solution to depth is absence, is by removing things like the background in order to create some sense of depth and sense of environment out of it. And here we have Shen Zhu's Lofty Mount Lu from 1461, which is a great piece. Quite hard to see on this board because it's very tall. And so this is sort of a banner, because a lot of this stuff, instead of being done on canvas or painted directly onto walls, a lot of it was onto silk or onto scrolls or onto parchment. So this is a kind of silk banner. It's sort of doing the role, fulfilling the role of, I guess, like a tapestry would, but whereas a tapestry, it's like the image is sewn into the tapestry itself. Here it's all painted, so you can see all that stuff like the spirit resonance and the bone method and all of that stuff in it. And it moves sort of south to north as well. So we have this, having this long, thin, very tall canvas, if we're going to use that term, or you know, the banner, allows you to have foreground and background, even though it's not a linear background, is because we have this far awayness of something that's that high and it's that kind of far away from you. You're looking up to it as you would be looking up to a mountain. And as you get closer and you look down at something that's near you, you'll notice that the space becomes a lot more closer. So it's as if the closer that you are to the sheet also reflects the closeness that the hypothetical viewer is to the image being depicted, the painter to the things they're depicting. So at the bottom, everything's close up. It's as if you're stood in there looking at people, in this case, stood by a pool there, reflecting on the white water passing past him. And we have our little philosopher down here, he's about 2 inches tall, and he's underneath the tree. And he's so small, but he's very peaceful and restful. And he's thinking about this water that's traveled all the way up here, going past this little bridge, up into this kind of chaos and confusion of the waterfall, and it goes all the way up to the top of this mountain. And down here we've got kind of a lake as well, a body of water with some sort of little buildings right next to it. So we have whole cities, whole mountains, and down here is the philosopher sort of thinking about all of them. And that movement of water is a very sort of Taoist image, the idea that you can, well, Heraclitus says you can never step into the same river twice, and it's that same image in Taoism, that the river is simultaneously, it's always new water coming past, but it's always the same river. It's that change and stasis in the same moment, and he's considering the whole world through the river that's coming down the mountain there. So this is Shen Zhu's Fisherman at Sunset, and we can kind of just see here the sort of emergence of this style that's here we've got bits of colour emerging. This is a more popular piece. The kind of Chinese cultural inflexibility so China has this huge spans of time in which things change in little ways, but it always sort of looks quite similar, the art. It's similar to the Egyptian art style, other than the fact that there are slight differences each time it's kind of iterated upon. So we go from the Song to the Tang to the Song to the Ming. Now, we'll take a quick sojourn over to Japan towards the end here. And you can see how Japanese art sort of towards that Ming period, where Japan starts gaining its independence and starts kind of defending it a lot more militarily against the Chinese, who'd previously kind of ruled over them, and then they'd had this interaction with their different... culture of Japan and the culture of China are almost identical at certain points. But as Japan breaks away, it starts to develop its own techniques, which kind of just take it to the next level, this idea of these ideas emerging under Chinese art. And in the same way, Japan develops Zen Buddhism, which is like Buddhism to the next extent, to the next level, where simply doing the actions of every day, reflecting on everyday actions, is more important than an iconic or iconic art or anything like this. And so we have things like the idea of gi ware in China, which is the kind of intentionally cracked pot, is replaced or kind of supplemented in Japan with the art of kintsugi, which is whenever you break a bowl, you can fix the breakage with gold, like melted down liquid gold. And it means that the broken thing is now more beautiful than it was before it was broken. So taking into account accidents and time and fallibility and sort of death and breakage and making them and celebrating that in a more beautiful way than it was when it was whole is part of the Zen thing. And also you have, I think, yeah, Sumie style, which is kind of that minimalist style of which we see in Chinese art, but taken to the next extent. So Sumie just kind of means ink style, you working with inks, but it also represents a slightly different take on the use of inks, where some of this, particularly kind of 18th century Japanese stuff, it's so minimalist. It just looks initially when you see it like a series of ink blots on the page, or like he's taken a brush and just squiggled it. But the closer you look, the more detail you can see. So here we have a waterfall on a high mountain looking out over a forest in the background. And it just looks like a series of splatters, really, with maybe a little bit of kind of white there to depict the water. But the closer you look and then the further away you get, in that movement you find all this depth. When you look at this art of Sumei, kind of minimalist style Sumei, you find loads of these really fascinating pieces. Yeah, so, and also with Japan gets technologically more advanced than China quite quickly. And so we also get emerging the sort of print block art. So here's a famous Hokusai piece, which has all that quality of Eastern art. So there's no attempt at linear perspective. The background is supplied purely by Mount Fuji there, but all the interest is in this huge rolling wave, a huge amount of movement. And because it's a woodblock print, you can also incorporate, you know, a limited flat set of palettes to it, so you've got color as well. And so all this movement and energy is included in this piece. We have another piece by Hokusai, who's really great, the Tenman Bridge here. This was called Yukioe art, which was all print-based art, which was popular art. It was intended to be sold to the everyday person. It's a little bit like character art in the Dutch Golden Age, where it's being sold to the average person based on the kind of increasingly large middle class because of trade and because of the developments in technology. And so it depicts scenes familiar to people. So this is a famous bridge, Tenman Bridge, and we've got all the people moving across it. We've got these various sort of figures and the little town there. Yukioe art is also sort of famous for, its great practitioners were all tended to be quite poor. They lived in areas where there were a lot of bandits and there was a lot of kind of criminals, and there tended to be, the red light district would always be the kind of place where they would hang out. And yet they created this very beautiful art that's kind of transcended where they were from. Hiroshige is another Japanese kind of artist who works in the Yukioe style. We can see here the presence and absence of colour have doing a lot of work in terms of signification. So we have this winter scene, very chilly winter scene, but the splashes of colour on our three figures, two of them moving off one way, one in the other direction, just really fills it with this sense of life and energy. And you can kind of see them with their heads bowed down and kind of feel, you know, what it's like for them moving through this white kind of area. And then Yoshitsuya, this is Princess Suragane fighting the evil Sotoko Inn from 1855. So Yoshitsuya is particularly interesting because he's sort of, you can almost see him as the grandfather of manga. He's, of all of the different ukiyo-e artists, he's the one most interested in the human figure, and it's particularly the human figure in combat. So there's always like demons and samurai and ancient warriors and sort of folk tales. And he uses a lot of techniques which become kind of popular in comics, like the use of lines to depict energy flowing and sort of laser beams and spiritual powers and flapping things and environmental effects that come in to create a kind of sense of lasers and kind of effects going on. And it's all done in that line art style as well, which is kind of comic book inspired as well. So yeah, the next one here, we got Hasui Kawase. So this is from the 19th century, sort of 18th, 19th century. And then as the 19th century kind of moves into the 20th century, ukiyo-e art and Japanese art starts to speak to Western art. So I think the greatest artist of this period is Hasui Kawase, whose work has clearly taken a huge amount from Western art, but it's still recognisably working in the UK early style. So it's that woodblock print, it's using presence and absence, it's using kind of small figures on a big landscape. It's also got a very, it's got some integration of linear perspective taken from Western art, but it's still the sensibility of Eastern art. And he's got these pieces like this one as well, which is quite clearly drawn, you know, from West, the inspiration is drawn from Western art, but it retains a lot of the Eastern art elements. And it's this kind of meeting of the two forms and two forces that we'll see next week as we sort of double back to the 19th century and look at Impressionism. This is what's going on in this kind of meeting of East and West. So all of those sort of highly sophisticated techniques of flat colours, of understanding presence and absence, of composition, are taken from the East into the West, but at the same time from the West comes this new kind of focus on photorealism, on depth and perspective, and on lighting effects and colour as well, which we can see here in this piece. So, yeah, hopefully we've seen, as we return to our picture of a bird sat on a branch, that the Eastern tradition, all like 2,000, 3,000 years of it that we've looked at there, well, some of that was 10,000 BC, so, you know, 13,000 years of it, has loads of commonalities with the Western tradition and with any tradition of art, because art tends to follow particular stages of development as the society inside it grows and as it develops sort of different techniques. But there's also this kind of fundamental philosophical set of differences there, which, as we'll see next week, once we get to Impressionism, there's just loads and loads of sort of discourse and kind of meeting of minds between the two of them. So we shall end it there.